Settle down. Thanks. My name's Anne Phillips. I'm Professor of Gender Theory at the LSE Gender Institute, and it's a great such a great pleasure. Yeah, well, there we go. Great pleasure to welcome you to this third in the series of directors' lectures. I work in the field of political theory, mainly feminist political theory, with a particular emphasis on issues of equality and democracy. And I'm a relative newcomer at LSE. I mean, you'll find at LSE that there are a lot of people who've been here for a long time, which I take not as evidence that they're all stuck in their ways and can't face the risks of modern society, but rather that once people come to LSE, they rather want to stay here. And one of the things that I very much value about LSE is precisely the very, very sort of strong importance that's given to political and intellectual engagement with the key issues of the day. And I think the tradition, the new tradition that's been introduced of the director's lectures is one indication of that. Just to say, in case I forget in the kind of flow of debate, this is the last of this series for this term, and the fourth lecture in the series is on the 23rd of January, but will be in the Old Theatre rather than the Peacock Theatre, so just to bear that in mind for next term. Just to fill you in on the format, Tony Giddens will give his lecture, then I get the first crack at asking some questions, raising some issues, but then we leave time before 2 o'clock for a number of you also to put questions to the speaker. So over to Tony Giddens for the future of global inequality.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. And we were very pleased to have Anne join the LSE, and she's made a big impact since she came. Anyone interested in gender studies should certainly check the website, Gender Institute, and also check Anne's own publications, which include a very distinguished book on inequality. Just to add to what she said, I'll be giving two more lectures in this series. The fourth one's going to be about the global future of the family and personal life, because I think transformations affecting personal life are just as important as those affecting the big institutions. And of course, the position of women is a key part of that in terms of when you look at it in a global perspective. And the last one I'll be talking about, the future of democracy. Is democracy under in a situation of stress and strain, or is it true to say that democracy, conversely, is spreading around the world? And both those lectures, as was mentioned, will be next term. In this lecture, what I'm going to talk about is inequality. And I think one has to start by asking why inequality matters in the social sciences. It does matter a lot. Inequality matters, first of all, because inequality is a moral issue. If you have a society in which there's a vast gulf between rich and poor, that vast gulf is plausibly not morally defensible to say that groups who are very deprived are effectively part of the same social community as those who are very privileged. This would apply not just, I think, on a national level, but also on a global level. Inequality always has, I think, a moral component, ethical component, if you like, about what kind of society is acceptable to us nationally and globally. But that's not the prime reason, I think, why inequality is so important for us in the social sciences and why the issue of what's happening to world inequalities is so significant. Inequality matters to us primarily because inequality is not just a statistical thing, it's not just a measure of how many resources people control. Inequality has a direct impact on citizenship, and there's a strong sense in which you can say that if people are underprivileged, if people are impoverished, they do not have the chance to exercise whatever citizenship rights might be allocated to them. So even in a democratic society where there are nominal rights of full political participation, if you're impoverished, if you're poor, you might de facto be excluded from participation in central democratic institutions, because if you're someone living on a very low income, other things tend to flow from that: poor schooling, poor job opportunities, and so forth. So inequality matters because it impinges upon rights of citizenship nationally, but it also matters globally, we're in some sense all citizens of a wider world community, and many people, one could say, are disenfranchised from effective membership of that wider world community which is coming into being. Now, one should also start by saying that inequality means many things. As Anne says very beautifully in her book, there are many different kinds of inequalities. There are inequalities of income, there are inequalities of wealth, of course, but there are also inequalities between the sexes, there are cultural inequalities, there are ethnic inequalities, there are inequalities between the generations, between young and old. So inequality can mean many different things. It's quite important because changes going on in one dimension of inequality might be opposite, move in the opposite direction from those going on in other dimensions of inequality, although normally I think they tend to cluster with one another. In this lecture, what I'll be talking about is primarily economic inequality, and I'll be talking primarily about income inequality, and I'd like to try in the 35 minutes that I've got to speak to cover three broad issues. First, what is happening to economic inequality in the richer countries, in the industrialized sector of the world, especially what has happened over the past 30 or so years to inequality in these countries. Second, what is happening to inequality globally, what seems to be the emerging trend, what kinds of relationships are there between the rich and poor countries on a global level, and third, what can we do about it? What practical policies are there for overcoming or reducing inequalities within the industrial countries and on a more global level? By the industrial countries, you mean the countries of the European Union, the United States, Australasia, Japan, those countries which have passed through the industrial transition, plainly different from about two-thirds of the rest of the societies in the world. What's happened over the past period in these countries? Well, there are four main points that I'd like to register with you. First, if you look at the industrial countries over the period from about 1950 to 1970, that is the immediate post-war period in the industrialized world, you find a pretty clear pattern of an overall reduction in levels of economic inequality. Economic inequality became muted or reduced over the post-war period. Most people would say that a strong influence on that reduction of inequality in industrial countries was the expansion of welfare systems, expansion of the welfare state, and the introduction of progressive taxation measures within the industrial states. Although there are controversies about it, but most people would say those things were closely connected, at least, with trends towards reducing inequality. But what's happened over the past 20 or 30 years since that period, since 1970, 30 years since then, is a partial reversion of that trend. That is, economic inequality has been widening in the majority of industrial countries, at least as it's ordinarily measured. I should stress there are big problems in measuring inequality. There are big problems of comparison between countries. It's especially important to note this when we come to look at inequalities in the rest of the world, global inequalities, but it's also important to register it for comparing any inequalities. It's often quite difficult because statistical sources are not wholly adequate. But within that parameter, inequalities in most countries have got worse over the past 30 or so years. Not universally so, because by orthodox measures, there are some industrial countries which have become more equal over that period. No one knows why. For example, Italy is a country where economic differentials seem to have narrowed rather than have expanded, at least according to orthodox studies. No one really has a clue whether that is accurate or what that means, but by and large, a period of reducing inequality has been replaced by a period where inequalities on the whole have increased, economic inequalities have increased. Not true of all inequalities, and that's why it's important to stress the different versions of inequality that there are. for example, inequalities between men and women in some key respects have become reduced over that period, and I think you could probably say the same about sexual minorities, gay groups, various kinds of partly excluded cultural groups. For some of them anyway, inequalities have become reduced rather than increased over that time, especially in the core industrial countries. But on the whole, inequality, economic inequality, seems to have gone up over that period. Second, there are pretty big differences between different industrial countries in terms of official measures of economic inequality. And those patterns, interestingly, those differences have remained the same over the period when economic inequalities as a whole went down and over the period where economic inequalities went up. The most egalitarian countries, those with the lowest amount of variance in their distribution of income, the Scandinavian countries in Europe, and presumably no coincidence that they're the countries that spend most on welfare measures and have retained most of a universalized welfare system. In the middle, you have a group of countries which includes the UK, Germany, France, which are middle range in terms of the levels of economic inequality. And those countries in the third category that have the highest levels of economic inequality include, above all, the United States, which by many measures is the most economically unequal country in the world and has been so through most of the post-war period, but also normally includes Israel and New Zealand. New Zealand, which for a certain period had a very aggressive market-based philosophy underlying its government, even though that government was supposedly left of centre government, seems to have seen a greater worsening of economic inequalities over the past 30 years until recently than almost any other industrial country. But the patterns seem to stay pretty much the same, even through these changes. Third, is a very important feature of inequality, which social scientists have only recently begun to understand and get to terms with, which is not only important, I think, in the industrial countries, but elsewhere too. This is that most comparisons of inequality, until quite recently, were statistical comparisons. They only compared at any one point the proportion of people living below a certain income line or distributed across a certain range of incomes. What they didn't do was to trace out individual careers, so that at any one time you didn't know who the poor actually were. And certainly in industrial countries, many sociologists and others had the assumption that if you were poor, by and large, you tended to stay poor, so that you didn't perhaps need to study too much the individual trajectories of people. Over the past 10 years, for the first time, we've got a range of studies which actually look at what happens to individuals. In other words, which look at individuals moving in and out of poverty. And those have produced conclusions which have surprised many people. John Hills, HILLS, who's the head of the Social Exclusion Unit in the LSE, is one of the scholars leading this movement. What's been found, for example, in a study in Germany, was that about 30% of the population over a 10-year period from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s at some point were poor by orthodox EU measures of poverty. But a high proportion of that 30% also moved out of poverty over that period. There is quite a lot more movement in and out of poverty than we previously realized, and we just don't know how far these findings are generalizable. They're very important because if you're thinking about policy making, what's arguably most important is not at any one point how many people are right at the bottom, but whether they have the chance to get good jobs and move on, whether they're stuck there or not. Plenty of people do get stuck there and plenty of people drop back into poverty, but there is quite a lot more mobility, certainly from bottom to sort of lower middle of the income scale, than most of us thought until a few years ago. You don't have an accurate picture of poverty and deprivation, the bottom end of inequality, unless you have a picture of careers, of what careers individuals follow, and therefore you need about 20, 25 year picture, really, of what happens to individuals over the course of the main part of their working life. Fourthly, in the industrial countries, over this period, there have been big changes in the structure of inequality, which reflect also on the dynamics, the sort of causal components of inequality, primarily associated with a tremendous transformation of the economy and the labour force. In most industrial countries, until about the period I mentioned, until about 30 years ago, something like 40%, sometimes as many as 45% of the population worked in blue-collar manufacture. There was, in other words, a big working class. Many people in this working class lived in relatively impoverished circumstances. Now, in the industrial countries, there's only 16% of the population on average in the EU who work in manufacturing labour. And of course, many of the older working class communities in mining and shipbuilding and so forth have more or less completely disappeared. So you have a transformation of the class system. And what's happened in Western countries is you have much bigger, relatively affluent middle than you had before. But at the bottom, you have something like between 5 to 10%, variable between different countries, living in conditions of poverty, as those are usually measured. And the bottom 5% of that 5 to 10% are often more or less fairly systematically excluded from participation in the wider society. This is the reason why the idea of social exclusion has become so common in analyzing Western countries. The notion of social exclusion was invented by social scientists from the OECD who noticed the structural transformation. Part of it is a result of the welfare state because, for example, you have a whole range of decaying housing estates in European countries built for the best of purposes, where people have poor education, have very few job opportunities, where there are high levels of crime, high levels of truancy, high levels of delinquency, very difficult to escape. And of course, minority groups often tend to be concentrated in these areas. So there are important structural shifts, and the policies of most political parties express that shift because you must have targeted anti-poverty policies in order to try to overcome social exclusion. You can't just depend upon traditional passive income transfers as used to be the case. So the nature of inequality in Western countries has changed quite a lot over the last three decades. And you have to ask why. Is it anything to do with what I've been discussing in these lectures, wider world trends? Is it anything to do with the notorious globalization? Many people have a story which suggests that it is, because the story that suggests that globalization has kind of eroded the capacity of Western states and has therefore undermined welfare systems, that theory argues that with increasing globalization, states lose control of some of the capacities they had previously. These include welfare capacities, the capability of supporting extensive welfare systems, which then can help you mute or reduce inequality. Is this story correct? I think the answer is pretty plain. The answer is no. This story is not correct. It is not primarily globalization. In any sense of that term, whether in the richer sense of the term I mentioned, or in a narrow sense of globalization, the expansion of global markets, the impact of financial systems, which primarily explains transformations in patterns of inequality in industrial countries. It is mainly the following factors, and we can be fairly confident about them because there have been numerous studies of them over the recent period. First is technological change. Technological change, of course, is associated with globalization because driving force of technology is often driving force of businesses that need to adapt to the world marketplace. But technology has produced massive changes because of the emergence of the knowledge economy, because of the changes I just mentioned, the disappearance or the shrinkage of traditional manufacturing working class. This means that whole categories of people that used to have pretty good job opportunities no longer do so, especially unskilled male workers. Most European and other industrial countries have serious, serious problems with disenfranchised younger men who are not disenfranchised, of course, from the political system nominally, but de facto are disenfranchised because there are no job opportunities for them. Many such people are concentrated in areas of social exclusion, but others are not. There is much less demand for unskilled labour, especially unskilled male workers in industrial economies than there used to be. Second big factor affecting this, changes in the family, the thing I'm going to talk about in the fourth lecture. A study of the United States, which looked at expanding income differentials in the US over the past 30 years, concluded that changes in the structure of the family there explain no less than 40% of the variance, 40% of the increase in inequality in that country over this period. Changes in the structure of the family, particularly those which means you have a rising proportion of lone parent families headed by a single parent, normally a single mother, bringing up children under conditions in which it's very difficult to get good employment. And in countries that don't have very extensive welfare systems, such as the United States, people in such categories, and this includes children, tend to drift into poverty. The problem of child poverty is a massive problem associated with this. Those countries where it's least developed, where there's least child poverty, and there's least poverty among lone parents, are countries like Denmark, which have very, very high level of state provision for single women bringing up children. And in those countries, you find they've managed to prevent the worst aspects of these changes of developing. But in the United States and a range of industrial countries, including this one, they have not. Child poverty in this country is one of the biggest problems which we face, which we have to address over the next 10 to 20 or so years. Thirdly, demographic changes. Demographic changes have radically altered, especially the generational structure of Western countries. You have a lot more older people in Western countries. You have fewer younger people because birth rates are so low. It's exactly the opposite of developing countries, which have a completely reverse demographic structure. The high proportion of young people, low proportion of old people. But when you have countries like Western ones with a high proportion of older people, many of those people are outside the labour force, they've retired from the labour force, they're therefore not bringing in, as it were, the income they used to bring in, and many countries have an issue of the poverty of older people to go along with the poverty of children, changing the sort of patterns of inequality within these countries. Now, what one should do about these things, what kinds of policies will help to reverse some of these changes, I'll come to that later on, because I think, surprising as it may seem, I think some of the main strategies for reducing inequality and for overcoming poverty are pretty much the same in the industrial world as in the developing world, and they're pretty much the same whether they apply on a global level or whether they apply within countries. But what's happening to wider inequalities? What's happening to global inequalities? Because it's here that so many people feel concern, I think. Many of us are concerned about what's happening in industrial countries, but industrial countries, after all, even if you're pretty poor, you're rich by the standards of the least developed countries of the world. So it's with good reason, I think, that the anti-globalization movement and other protest movements have singled out inequality as a fundamental problem facing world society for the next generation. And it's rather crucial to get a grasp on what's actually happening, because if you don't get a grasp on what's actually happening, of course it's not possible to develop adequate policies to try to improve things. The inequalities between the rich countries of the world and the poor countries of the world, by any definition, are extreme. Nobody denies, I think, they are extreme, but there are massive controversies, very big controversies, about what's actually happening to trends in the inequalities between the richer part of the world and the poor countries of the world. Now, many people who've taken to the streets, who've joined protest movements, They've argued that the world is becoming more unequal. That is, the division between the richer countries and the poorer countries, especially those at the top end of the industrial countries and those at the bottom end of the developing world, is getting much larger, and that this process of expansion of inequality is driven by globalizing forces. Again, it's really central to decide how far these assertions are true. Now, it's not a simple matter to measure world inequalities, partly because of statistical difficulties, partly because social scientists are actually divided about what the trends really show. No one denies that there are extreme inequalities, but where there is controversy is about whether these inequalities are worsening, and of course, if they are worsening, what the causes of this deterioration are. Now, you have a number of measures which you can use to chart global inequalities, and they tend to produce a different picture of what's going on in the world from one another. First, many, especially of the older studies, and these are the studies I feel in which quite a number of the people who picked up the idea that the world is simply becoming radically more unequal and that this is the result of globalization, they depend, I think, on these older studies. Older studies tended to use a measure of inequality which is quite questionable. What they did was to compare the GDP per head in poorer countries with richer countries as a simple straightforward comparison, forgetting about differences in rates of exchange between currencies and forgetting about the cost of living within different countries. Those are the simplest kind of comparisons that one can make. If you use that as a comparison, that comparison shows inequalities to be widening, and widening quite substantially over the past 30 years. But it's not the best way to measure them. So second, what people turned to was including what's within their comparisons what's called purchasing power parity. Purchasing power parity means you don't just compare naked economic statistics between countries. You factor in the cost of living, how much it costs to buy food and so forth within a country. Cost of living in poorer countries is lower than it is in richer countries. So as you would expect, if you factor in PPP, then the growing division between rich and poor becomes less than if you use the first measure. First measure shows biggest increase in inequality. Second shows a lower increase, but still an increase in inequality over the past 30 years, at least as measured by most studies. But there is a third measure, which at least some people feel to be the most revealing measure of all, which is where you include population levels and population growth. Many people say, many scholars say, it doesn't make much sense to compare a country like China with a country, say, like Botswana. China has over a billion people. Botswana has a few million people. Doesn't make sense averaging out GDP in those countries, lumping them all together as poorer countries, neglecting the factor of not just population size, but also levels of population growth. If you then compare not countries, but populations, you do get a different picture. Most scholars agree, although this is also still controversial, if you measure world population in relation to inequality, that the picture emerges as the following one. Inequalities increased for most of this century up to about 1960, as measured in relation to population numbers rather than nations. After 1960, these inequalities seem to have stabilized, or according to some studies, got less over the past 30 or so years. One big factor in this is simply rising number of more affluent people in China and the Asian economies, which over the past 30 or so years, some of them, as we all know, have demonstrated extraordinary economic success. So if you have a lot of people getting richer in China, it has a global effect because China has so many people. There's such a high proportion of the world's population as a whole. Which of these measures should you use? Are global inequalities worsening or not? Well, I recommend to you, if you haven't read anything on this issue, a series of articles that he sent me by Robert Wade, W-A-D-E, who's a professor at the LSE, who also joined the LSE relatively recently, and again, we're very pleased that he came here. He wrote an article in The Economist magazine, I think it's about April this year, which dissects some of these statistics and dissects some of these concerns. Are global inequalities increasing? I think actually it's hard to make an assessment of that. So I think it doesn't actually make too much sense, simply to speak as most people do, in terms of overall global economic divisions. I think the things to look at are really the following, primarily. Regional disparities, because there are big differences in the trajectory of changes in inequality in the different regions of the world, the different continents of the world, if you like, over the past 30 or so years, and then differences within industrializing countries in terms of how far there have been regional imbalances and inequality within them, not just between them and the richer countries of the world. Well, what does studies show that take this regional orientation? I think there, most studies do tend to be in some substantial agreement, and they show quite different picture for different parts of the world. For the industrialized world, they show the picture that I described earlier. For Asia, you have substantial chunks of East Asia, including China above all, but also the other successful Asian economies, which have reduced the gap between themselves and the Western economies. Necessarily is the case because in the successful Asian economies over the past 30 or so years, you've had much higher growth rates with relatively stable population growth than you've had in the industrial countries. So it's a sort of logical point that those countries have become more equal in relation to Western countries rather than less equal. And it's easy to point to extraordinary examples of that. So if you take the case of Korea, in the 1960s, Korea was poorer than Ghana per head of population in relation to GDP. Today it's richer than Portugal per head of population. Portugal is a member of the European Union, one of the most industrial developed countries in the world. So there are sections of East Asia which have been dramatically successful and have reduced the gap between them and the industrial countries, even though the gap still exists. Of course, there are still impoverished parts of Asia, especially regional impoverishment in Asia, and large parts of India, Southeast Asia, and so forth. In Latin America, the picture looks different. And in Mexico and the rest of Latin America, most studies suggest there hasn't been a great deal of change. That is, there hasn't been a great deal of overall improvement of the fortunes. Latin American subcontinent as compared to the industrial countries of the world over the past 30 or so years, although some countries like Chile have scored significant successes in economic development. But within countries in Latin America, especially the bigger countries like Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, economic inequalities, regional inequalities within those countries, by most studies, seem to have got worse rather than better over that period. So Latin America does not seem, even Latin America, by the way, was the kind of area where neoliberalism, where market fundamentalism, if you like, became most powerful. So I think you have to say, although that orientation to development, so-called Washington consensus, the idea that the most important thing in development and leveraging people out of poverty and reducing inequality along the way is a simple exposure to deregulated markets, I think after that experiment, by and large, has not worked in Latin America, and Latin America is suffering many consequences for it at the moment. And then you have the case of Africa. Africa is the continent which seems most disturbing in terms of what's happened in the major African countries over the past 30 years. In the 60s, several of the major African countries were sources of great hope. Many people thought there could be period of rapid economic development in the major African countries. It has not happened. There's not really a single case of dramatic economic development in Africa over that period. And many of the worst problems of world society are concentrated in Africa, They're not just, of course, problems of economic inequality. They're not just problems of deprivation. They're also overlap with the impact of AIDS, of local civil wars, and many other difficulties which some of the core African countries have experienced. So I think it's quite right to say the world community must turn its attention to Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, as a region of concentration of effort and involvement if the situation is to be changed. Africa contains, so far as I can see, the only countries, more not quite the only countries, but most of the countries which have experienced, at least in some of their regions, a real drop in GDP, a real drop in income over this period. Mostly you're talking about relative differences between poorer and richer countries. But in Africa, you're to some extent talking about absolute patterns of economic decline, absolute expansion of poverty, at least in some core areas or key parts of major countries within that continent. Is all this, can you explain these patterns as a result of globalization? Well, I think by and large, again, the answer is no. That is to say, globalization understood either a narrow sense of the expansion of competitive markets, if you like the Washington Consensus, or globalization in the richer sense, as I suggested it should have. Globalization is not the driving force, the prime driving force behind the patterns we see, even though it is involved to some degree in all of them. Why? What's happening in Africa? Well, what's happening in Africa over the last few years is not primarily a result of Africa being included in the wider development of the world economy. It's partly a result of Africa being excluded from that development. What affected Africa? So of course, the long-term history of colonial involvement and the problems of decolonialism which followed, but perhaps more than anything, the fact that large parts of Africa, like some parts of Asia, were the areas where the Cold War was fought between the two major superpowers, and including big areas of Central America, for instance, would be in the same category. And we are seeing now the consequences of what happened 30, 40 years ago, rather than what's happening over the past 10 or so years. These are areas which have been riven by war, where the two superpowers have fought their wars by proxy. It was often said that there was a Cold War period. Of course, that's a normal term to describe that period, but it was actually a hot war period. The Cold War powers fought a hot war in the peripheral, so-called peripheral parts of the world, in the less developed parts of the world. And many of the conflicts which developed then, we're reaping the harvest of them in those parts of the world today. And what can one do about it? What are the major policies? Oh God, time has already gone. What are the major policies that should be instituted to try to counter inequality in the industrialized world and within the larger world society? Well, there are three basic things to be done, I think, and I have to go through them pretty quickly. First, redistribution must play a role. Redistribution means transfer of assets from more wealthy countries or more wealthy sections of countries to poorer sections of countries or to poorer countries. Taxation system in richer countries fulfills that function. Taxation, progressive taxation, has a big impact on the post-tax distribution of income in all industrial countries. Can you do the same thing on a world level? Well, only to a limited degree. But I feel we must take seriously the discussion of the Tobin tax, which is now on the agenda and has been Tobin tax, you probably know, named after the economist James Tobin, who set it out about 30 years ago, actually, the idea of having a tax on speculative financial transactions, which could generate income, which could be devoted to purposes of development. The French anti-globalization group ATTAC, A-T-T-A-C, has emerged as one of the main proponents of having a serious discussion of Tobin tax. Now, Tobin meant his tax to be primarily a way of smoothing the world economy. He didn't see it as a redistributive measure, primarily, and he still today doesn't see it primarily as a redistributive measure. But I thought it's important that the industrial countries especially consider whether it is practical. And I think whatever you make of the anti-globalization movements, it has come on the political agenda. Gordon Brown in New York 2 days ago said that the Tobin tax should be on the agenda of the richer countries. the French government, I think 4 days ago, actually enshrined it as part of their policy. Will it work? Well, we could discuss that maybe afterwards. There are many practical problems facing it. Second, the only core way of overcoming poverty, certainly, and thereby also attacking inequality, the only way in which we know in which millions of people can be leveraged out of poverty is economic development in which the poor participate. Redistribution is never going to make more than a relatively marginal difference on the world scene, nor is it going to make more than a relatively marginal difference in industrial countries. Economic development in which the poor have jobs, in which the poor are incorporated, hopefully above a decent minimum wage, is the only way we know in which you can make a mass attack, as it were, upon poverty and deprivation. How do you achieve it? What we know is you don't achieve it, I think, through a straightforward market-based philosophy. It is not right to suppose that a poorer country will automatically prosper if it opens out its economy to the world marketplace. The best writer on these issues, I feel, over recent years is Joe Stiglitz, S-T-I-G-L-I-T-Z. Joe Stiglitz was chief economist at the World Bank. When he left the World Bank, there were a series of articles about the lapses of World Bank and IMF policies, in which he argues that there is no single known case of development in the world in which the state does not play a part. State and government are crucial for economic development, and I think this to be true. State and government are crucial, but state and government must not dominate. So you need a kind of relationship between constructing conditions of a market economy, government involvement to help that, and the involvement of other groups, especially civil society groups, as well. We know a lot more about that than we did, but we also know there is no magical key to development. One of the main points Stiglitz makes, very important point, is that what we've learned over the past 20 or so years is that establishing a market economy, which is a key to economic prosperity, in a developing country is very, very difficult. And you cannot do it simply by importing market mechanisms. You must have other institutions of law, of a non-corrupt state, of political transformation, which are the condition of an effective market economy. Thirdly and finally, the world economy is loaded. It's loaded against the developing countries. That's what many people quite rightly are protesting about. You can see this in some of the measures enacted by the WTO and other global organizations, which in effect have a double philosophy. Philosophy is free trade for poorer countries, but protectionism within the richer ones. Protectionism still remains important in richer countries, especially in agricultural policy within the European Union, the United States. The EU has just passed measures which hopefully will open up its agricultural markets more to markets from developing countries, but these changes have not gone far enough. Is not a level playing field institutionally or economically in the wider world society, and we have to make it such if these other measures are to prove effective. Well, thank you. I'll stop now. Anne's got to be very quick and ask me these questions.
Okay. Okay, well, I'll be very quick. You've set out a number of what you see as the kind of the social and technological changes which are kind of contributing to the contemporary pattern of global inequality. But also, as is clear from your final comments about strategy, the kind of patterns of global inequality also at least partly reflect the sorts of claims that people make, the kinds of issues they mobilize around. And my own reading of sort of part of what's going on in the current context is that the ideas of equality have become sort of stronger and more pervasive in relation to certain issues about status equality or political equality, that this actually coincides with the period in which issues about economic equality really are not addressed except in terms of either poverty or questions of law and order. So, you know, an extensive gap that might open up problems of law and order would be regarded as a global issue, but not really a problem of economic inequality. So, one of the issues that I'd like to raise is, in a sense, what are the prospects for seriously addressing problems of economic inequality if, in many ways, that is no longer regarded as a major moral concern, to sort of go back to where you started.
Well, can I answer that quickly in two ways? First of all, I think global inequality has renewed itself as a moral concern, and that's largely because of the impact of social movements and NGOs who forced it onto the political agenda. I think that's a very important transition which has happened, even over the past 5 years, very important ideological transition. But second, I think it's quite right to say that the causes of inequality, as I was trying to say, are rarely or virtually never wholly economic. They're deeply bound up with the historical conditions that affect a particular country and other institutions, so that a country would not be able to leverage many of its poor people out of poverty by economic change alone. You always have to have institutional transformation, especially democratization, effective democratization of political institutions, and the nurturing of civil society institutions. These things are very difficult to do in poorer countries. But we do know from the experience of some, especially poor areas within poorer countries, that you can do a lot by local mobilization. There have been very successful examples of regional development, for example, in some areas of Brazil, and some cities within Brazil where this mobilization has taken place, and the same in some parts of Africa too. So we do know that you don't have to accept these things passively, but we do know you need a mixture of external input and internal dynamism, internal transformation. The countries involved have to actively participate, and they have to be helped by the richer countries in order to shift, as it were, the paradigm of development. Can I now just ask for a couple of questions from the floor? I'm sorry, there's not a lot of time remaining. Someone in the middle there? Is there a mic going around the room somewhere?
Does globalization, in your opinion, and how you conceive of globalization, necessarily need to be a westernization of the developing world? And if not, how do you avoid that tendency in globalization to westernize a lot of these countries and their cultures, as well as their economic system?
Excellent question. I think it's more complicated than it appears, because at least in my estimation of westernization, there are some things that are good about westernization and some are not so good. For example, principles of liberal democracy, of reconciling of different cultures within democratic system, if you regard that as Western, I regard those things as desirably universalizable. So I think it's in the interests of developing countries to become more democratic and to shift their institutions in that way. If you're talking about McDonald's, if you're talking about cultural impact of Americana, if you're talking about the actual naked power of Western countries, then I have to have a lot more reservations about those things. I think what we know is that globalization is a very mixed bag, that although you get a kind of veneer of a kind of global American culture, which is to some extent locked onto global corporate power, is when you're talking about American corporations that have this global spread. Globalization also, because it's so complicated, produces many forms of local autonomy too, produces many forms of resurgence of local culture, probably more than a standardizing one. So the reason to worry about sort of global impact, certainly some aspects of global corporate power and so forth, and you should also see that in many cases it's the opposite effect. So for example, you have lots of retrieval of local languages which weren't spoken previously but are now being retrieved. A strong emphasis upon retrieval of local culture, not just in developing countries but in richer countries too. So these things are not Western, and I think the impact of global communications therefore has this double kind of effect, a sort of veneer of universality, but underneath that also very important elements of diversity to counterbalance that. Please, I don't know if you want to shout, well, people can't probably hear you, so maybe you just wait a sec.
Hello, I'm Margaret Thomas, graduate of the school. I've worked for 20 years in the third world as a health economist.
Can you say where, for everyone's interest?
Everywhere, South America, Africa, Asia. The country I think that caused me the most distress when I worked there twice, was Nigeria. Because to go to Nigeria, here you have a resource-rich country.
Or Zambia, the same.
I never worked in Zambia, so I can only comment on Nigeria, but a rich resource country, and also many, many well-educated Nigerians.
Absolutely.
But the whole thing, when you work there, and I was working on public expenditure, the whole thing had gone down into a sort of vortex of decline. Much of it filled with corruption. And I came away from them, I think, more unhappy than I've come from anywhere else in the world. And it's that type of situation. You know, where is the answer in the globalization procedure? How can we influence things to improve that for the ordinary run of Nigerian people?
Yeah, no, I think just all that is very true and very much to the point. And you could reproduce that story from other countries in Africa, which are enormously sort of endowed with natural resources. And indeed, you could say Russia, which is still struggling, which has, you know, massive, massive, massive economic resources of the traditional type, that is physical resources and minerals and so forth. Well, I think there is no magic bullet solution to what you're saying, I think. And I think the richer countries have an absolute obligation to get together to pursue some of the things that have been pursued. For example, debt relief is very important to core African countries. I think it's quite important to set conditions for it, as they've tried to do, because otherwise, if you just relieve the debt and the same corrupt people who are stashing it all away in their bank accounts in Switzerland, while they're, you know, still in power, then so you need institutional transformation, which has to be supported as far as possible by the international community within those countries, which, as you say, are rich in human resources as well as natural resources. But I think there has to be internal change too, and none of us know completely how to achieve it. In Nigeria, for example, you do have this deteriorating spiral, and this is so common, I think, in African countries of the past 30 or so years. If I thought there was a simple way of reversing it, I would say what it was. I just don't think it's much to do with globalization. I think globalization actually can add a lot to African countries because it does make possible the mobilization of the wider international community. But simply allowing the country to be invaded by sort of Western corporations, or I suppose that would resolve the problem, is plainly not the case. All we can do, I think, is build as much as we're able to on those cases where countries have pulled themselves around from conditions of extreme poverty or deprivation. And we do have some examples of those, but they said, and especially in Asia, of course, but they suggest that cultural factors, not just what the West could do, or not just economic factors, are pretty deeply involved with economic development. But I do think we've got an obligation, the international community and the richer countries, to increase the proportion of money they give as aid, and to make sure it's used effectively, because we know a lot of aid got a bad name because it wasn't used very effectively. It simply fed corrupt elites. I think a lot of the problems of poorer countries are not really to do with globalization, not really to do with markets, they're to do with the state and the corrupt nature of the state apparatus in many poorer countries. Reforming that is very, very difficult, because you might have a military poised on the side to take over if there's a movement towards more democratic regime and so forth. So there is no magic bullet solution, but there is a lot that Western countries can do to help in Africa, and they should be doing it. Can I just thank you all for coming and say this is the last lecture of this term. I hope you're enjoying yourselves at the LSE, and even though it's a long way ahead, I'll wish you a happy Christmas and hope to see you next time. Thanks very much. Thank you to Anne.